After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is my colleague, Joe Healy. And a little bit later, we will be joined by Arkansas coach Dave Van Horn for this week's clubhouse conversation. Of course, the Razorbacks had another excellent season this year, making it to Omaha yet again. And so we're going to get into a little bit about 2022 with and 2023, looking ahead already with Coach Van Horn and all things Hogs here on the Baseball America College Podcast. We are also going to cover some of the updates that Joe made as he updated the top impact transfers that changed schools this offseason. That list expanded from 50 to 100 this week, so we're going to going to get into some of that here on the Baseball America College Podcast. It's August, Joe. There's not a whole lot going on. Some schools are getting started this week or next week, but we're rolling right on through the dog days of summer.
Indeed, we are. It is. Yeah, it is. It's about move-in time, which takes a lot of forms. You know, I know on the interwebs there is this all the discussion. I don't know if you've run into about Bama Rush Week. You know, it's become like a phenomenon, people posting social media clips of the sorority rush at Bama. So that is a reminder that school is upon us. And on a personal note, I was heading to or from, I forget, downtown Durham. I guess it was to downtown Durham over the weekend, and got caught in a pretty significant traffic jam as move-in was happening at NC Central, which is just outside downtown Durham. Rest in peace to the NC Central baseball program, but I did get caught up in that traffic. And so it was a reminder just hitting me right in the face that, oh yeah, that is what's happening this week. And I will, in an unscripted moment, I will ask you for your memories of your freshman year dorm move-in.
Well, before we touch on that, I was going to say, I talked to two different coaches within the last week who were moving their kids, into college. So, it's coming for everyone, whether you're coaching or going to play or whatever. Everyone seems to be dealing with the move-in. My freshman move-in, that's actually interesting you ask about that now, as Ball State just finished tearing down my freshman dorm, which was like the big freshman dorm that every campus, it feels like of a medium to big size state university had, that they built in the 50s or 60s. Housed the entire freshman class basically. Well, Ball State just finished tearing that down within the last month, so no more La Follette. I moved in. It was pretty straightforward move in, as I recall. I don't remember it being too hot or anything, but moved in, met my roommate, and you know, off we went freshman year.
Fair enough. I moved in basically by myself. My mom was a public school high school teacher, and my dad lived across the country. And so I was like, well, yeah, me and my high school buddy, my best friend in high school, we both went to Sam Houston, and we just drove up that day and moved ourselves in. We were staying in different dorms for the moment. I lived in Sam Houston Village to start, which at the time was this like brand, I think it had been open a year. Like I think one class of freshmen had lived in it before I did. And it was the first big apartment style dorm at Sam Houston, where I, you know, me and my roommate had our own separate bedrooms. We shared a bathroom, but it had a living space but we had our own separate bedrooms. And I lived in that dorm for the first semester. And my move-in memories are pretty like small too. Like I remember at one point my 1997 Toyota Corolla struggling in the hills of Huntsville, Texas. There was one driveway that you have to pull into that was at a really sharp incline. And I didn't quite get enough momentum going up and my car bottomed out on it. And then I had to press the accelerator to get up this hill and then almost got into an accident. And that might actually be my most memorable moment. Cause I, you know, was just nervous that I was going to get in a car accident my first day on campus. But my freshman year roommate was in a fraternity, which is no judgment there, but our dorm kind of became the place where a lot of his buddies from his fraternity would hang out. And they were actually pretty, you know, they would just come and hang out. And, you know, I sometimes would hang out with them, but oftentimes I was also working a part-time job. And so I was coming in late and just trying to go to bed because I had class in the morning and I just worked a shift or whatever. So like, it wasn't my ideal situation, but like, you know, it's just, you know, we got along, but then I got a call from the dean's office over Thanksgiving break. They had found alcohol in our fridge and I knew nothing of it. Honest to goodness, knew nothing of it. And so I guess my roommate had taken it upon himself to just have a real fun party in our dorm room over Thanksgiving break and had gotten caught, because why would you not, in that situation? The RA lived just down the hall. Thankfully he did the thing where he told the dean's office, hey, you know, and at this point he had not had the conversation with the dean, but he told the dean, yeah, that my roommate had nothing to do with that. So, you know, that wasn't, you know, let him off the hook. So he took the fall there, which, you know, was the right thing to do, cause that was, you know, his deal. But at the semester break, I moved out of that dorm, mostly just because I wanted to live with said best friend from high school. So I moved into the much less palatial Mitchell House, which had all of, it looked like a hostel. It felt like a hostel. And it had maybe 20 rooms in it, maybe 25. And also rest in peace, Mitchell House. It was torn down before I even graduated. It had been torn down to make room for a new dining hall. So Mitchell House was a very different living experience, right down to, you know, the concrete floors and the furniture all being built into the walls and all of that stuff. So move-in day is kind of, I'm with you, like pretty mundane, but my whole dorm situation as a freshman took a lot of different twists and turns. So that's the thing out there, is make sure incoming freshmen who are listening to this, which I'm sure there are just millions, you know, value
that demographic.
That's right. Value your comfortability with your roommate over like how nice or how, you know, fun your dorm is, because ultimately, if you don't jive with your roommate, and again, we got along, but we didn't click, you know? And so, you know, if you don't jive with your roommate, it's going to make things a little bit extra difficult. And if you can deal with a lot, including a dorm room that again, felt like a hostel and kind of was treated as such, and the beds were hospital beds and what have you, you can deal with a lot of that kind of stuff. If you and your roommate kind of get along and you get along with the people in the house and all that stuff. So That's my life lesson there, is value the relationship piece over the actual facilities of the dorm.
Yeah. So I would say that 100%. It's probably a little late for the freshmen that are moving in now. But if you're a high school senior, thinking about this for next year, that's right. That's our advice.
That's right.
I feel like if I was like really on top of my game, I could transition from that definitely into transfer situations, because like that does feel like a little bit of the, you know, like find where you're comfortable a bit, but like, I don't have it in me, as we record this morning, to make that deaf transition. It's August, it's the off season for us all. So Joe, you updated and expanded the list. Most importantly, you expanded the list from 50 to 100, and any players that were on the list that ended up getting drafted or signed as free agents have been removed from the list. So this is a lot of new players on the list, on this transfer list. And it's intended to be top impactful transfers. Any player on here has committed to a new school at this point, but at this point, very few impact players have not committed. That was maybe more of a important disclaimer when we talked about the 50, less so than on this 100. Tommy White remains number one. We did have a discussion about whether he or Paul Skeens should be number one on this list. Both are headed to LSU. So good news for the Tigers either way. But we left it with Tommy White. Also new into the top 10 is Jerron Watts Brown, who is moving from Long Beach State to Oklahoma State. He committed sometime in July. And so he is a new addition to the top of the list here. But any other thoughts you had about the top of this this top 100 impact transfer list?
Yeah, I mean, the debate for number one is interesting. You know, you on my behalf kind of canvassed some opinions out there in the industry to kind of see what the feedback was. And it was fairly mixed, but we kept it with White just because we didn't get a lot of people pounding the table for Paul Skeens that we definitely had to have him number one. It was split to the point where it was like, okay, let's go with kind of the gut reaction here, which for me was Tommy White number one. And
And also some of the questions that you had, or the reasons why you had White number one, that he hit 29 home runs, 27 home runs as a freshman at North Carolina State, an ACC school, like moving into, you know, the SEC, like, yeah, that's probably a step up. But it's not the same kind of step as, you know, Paul Skeens is a two-time All-American. I'm not here to question, like, he played for the collegiate national team twice, but we are talking about a player coming down from altitude, and the rise in competition from the Mountain West to the SEC is far greater than what Tommy White will experience.
No doubt. And there's also, you know, the stuff we talked about when he committed, because we separated that out as a new story to talk about on the podcast. Some of the stuff that's going to play into that, into his role at LSU, could also be part of this, right? Where he could be just as good a player, and his numbers on one side or the other could be just as good or better than what he did at Air Force, hypothetically. But he's not as impactful as he was at Air Force, because there is a scenario where, you know, his value as a member of the rotation, for example, is so great that he doesn't end up hitting as much, right? And so he ends up just mostly pitching and kind of doing some hitting, but he's less of a two-way player. Or the opposite could be true, right? Where, hey, we really like his catching, and so we also like that we have a power hitter behind the plate, and so maybe his role on the pitching staff is diminished, where maybe he goes back to being a reliever. So there are also, I think, just the logistics of what he's trying to do at a place like LSU are such that, again, he could be just as good but have a diminished role by no fault of his own, just the logistics of, hey, he's a catcher who's also trying to be a starting pitcher, at least on paper. So at Air Force, that's one thing. At LSU, it's a whole different deal. So that's also baked into it, just the idea that he might not be the impact two-way guy he's been his first 2 years. So
let's face it, comparing two-way players to one-way players is very challenging to do. It's something that we've been trying to do in college baseball for quite a long time, but you're now seeing the struggles that folks in the big leagues are having trying to determine, okay, so how do we value what Shohei Ohtani does versus what, Aaron Judge is doing, say, in the MVP race or whatever. Like, these are very difficult players to compare because they're doing something that is so unique when you compare them to almost any other player on the board, unless they also happen to be a two-way player.
Some of the other big picture things are that the proven pitching in general, but proven starting pitching is expensive, metaphorically speaking, but maybe also literally, when you look at this the top of this list, because you do have, you know, Hurston Waldrop at three, and Thatcher Hurd, who is proven but also coming off of a back injury, and back injury is kind of one of those injuries that makes people go like, because it's a little less certain than some of the other pitching injuries we tend to see. But Watts Brown, Cade Morris, Ross Dunn, Landon Gartman from Memphis going to Mississippi State. Like, those are all guys at the top of this list. And I don't want to say good bats are a dime a dozen. That's not really true. But as you start to work your way down this list and get closer to 50 and then closer to 75 and 100, you do start to see a change in the the type of player we're talking about. So the top of the list is very heavy on proven starting pitching. And yes, there are some dynamic pitching players, but that's where the high end talent really is, it feels like. Whereas you get down to the bottom of this list and it is very heavy on a couple of archetypes of players. One is mid-major power hitters moving up to power conferences. It feels like maybe the lesson of seeing Sonny D, and I don't think any of these hitters are quite Sonny D just because we saw at Samford that he was already that kind of hitter. But I think seeing the success of that model and others, there were others out there, but seeing the success of that model, I think has motivated some teams to kind of look at, okay, maybe that jump is not as big as we thought it was if we like the raw skills. So kind of the second half of this list is very heavy on that. There's also very heavy on, you know, it's almost a cliche when people talk about it, but everyone has guys who throw 95 these days at the college level. And I think these transfer rankings are proof of that. There are so many hard throwing relievers with good numbers and high strikeout rates and all of it who are transferring that some of those guys got left off, frankly. Like there are guys on the cutting room floor here. Teddy and I briefly talked about, and it was more of my idea and Teddy being like, well, here's why we should really consider this. I briefly debated going to 200 players because there are just a lot of guys in the cutting room floor here who I think are going to be, you know, impact transfers in one way or the other. But moral of the story, you definitely see the type of player transitioning on this list as we get further down to be a little bit over-indexed for mid-major power hitters, power arms that people you've never heard of who throw hard and have really good numbers. And the third I would say is versatile infielders. And that's really at the bottom of this list. You see guys like Grant Smith at Incarnate Word. He's not so much versatile as much as he's just a really steady shortstop. But Hunter Haas, you know, going from Arizona State to Texas A&M. Jake Dukart going from Oregon State to Texas Tech. David Bryant going from Radford to Virginia Tech. Those are just a few examples of guys who are either just shortstops, like for sure shortstops, or guys who can play every position on the infield. And so that's another archetype, I think, towards the back of this that you're seeing a lot of in the transfer portal. And furthermore, being valued at a level higher than you might anticipate, because a lot of those guys, you look at the numbers and you go, like it's a nice player, but they're bringing something else to the table that's a little bit harder to perceive, which is either a real steady hand defensively, or this guy is a Swiss Army knife of a defender that we can use anywhere on the field.
The idea that like you're bringing in a guy who can play shortstop, whether the intention is to play him at shortstop only, or to, if he doesn't win the shortstop job, he's a guy that you feel comfortable moving around the infield. That's something that coaches have always been looking for. Like there are just so few guys like it's so important to have a lockdown shortstop. You know, that is, and it's true behind the plate as well, that for many years, I, you know, talk to coaches in the fall about their recruiting class. And I say like, are you done? Or are you still looking? Or I'm just talking to somebody in the spring, like, oh, have you been out like looking at guys for next year or whatever? And they usually say like, oh, well, I'm looking for a junior college catcher, or like, oh, well, we take a junior college shortstop. And like those guys have always been very highly prioritized. So it is of no surprise now that you have access to a different sort of player that those players are in demand as four-year transfers. The value that they bring as a just somebody that you know at shortstop that is going to make all of the routine plays and maybe some of the spectacular ones, but at least catch and throw at shortstop. Like that has value at every single level of baseball. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised that group is finding a home on the top 100 here, because those are guys you can plug into the lineup and feel great about doing so. Any other surprises for you around here? We've seen over the last couple of years, some interesting guys moving up from the lower ranks, from Division II or Division III, and making an impact in the Division I world. I mean, this year you have Xavier Rivas coming from University of Indianapolis, going to Ole Miss. Southern Miss dip back into the Division III ranks after, I guess, Hunter Riggins came from Division II, but Southern Miss dipping back into the lower divisions for a pitcher, I found that to be interesting. Anything like that stand out for you, Joe?
I think it's interesting to see how teams that you might not have, you or I might not have valued as being, the results might not have been very good, but then you see where their players end up and it kind of makes you think like, huh. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't mean that as an indictment of where they were before, although I assume in some cases it is that where they were before just wasn't maximizing the talent. I think in some cases it can mean, oh, something was actually happening at this previous program. And now it is kind of a bummer. And this is the downside of the transfer portal. When you talk to coaches at the mid-major smaller program level is that, you know, it is harder to kind of build something year after year, because, you know, if your guys pop, they're going to have opportunities. And so you can see some of that stuff. One example that was obvious, and it was an early example, is Tulane. And I think we kind of knew that there was talent there. It's Tulane, right? But they also brought in a good class. These last couple of years, their classes have been pretty good, and there's some big name guys on there, and they got some of those guys back to campus. But you look at, you know, they've got guys at Ole Miss and Wake Forest and just kind of all over the place in terms of transferring out. One of the places you might not think of was Northwestern. And I think they might have, I'm going to control F this real quick, so bear with me, dear listener.
I think it's at least three.
Yeah, it might be four. So Northwestern has number 24 on this list, Ethan O'Donnell, an outfielder transferring to Virginia. Number 58, Anthony Calarco, a first baseman transferring to Ole Miss. Sean Sullivan, a left-hander transferring to Wake Forest. And Patrick Herrera, a second baseman transferring to Kentucky. So, and Herrera was a late addition. He was one of the kind of the last guys that made it on to the 100. So, but they have four, Northwestern has four outgoing players on this list, and they're two going to the ACC, and both teams we expect to be very good in the ACC, and two players going to the SEC. So it is kind of interesting to see situations like that where players on teams that you might not have valued that highly. You know, Northwestern was a team that didn't make the Big Ten tournament last year. I mean, they were close. I think they lost out on maybe on a tiebreaker, or they were ninth or whatever. Didn't make the Big Ten tournament, and now has four pretty prominent players going to big time programs. And so it shows that there was probably something brewing there, because a lot of these are also younger players. Like these are, you know, with the exception, I think Calarco is an older player, but the rest of them are younger players in terms of their playing years. So something was probably happening there at Northwestern, and now they won't be able to see that quite to fruition. But it is kind of an interesting phenomenon you can see throughout the portal is where the players are coming from. We fixate on where the players go, and I get that. That's the point. But it is also interesting to see the inverse of where the players are coming from.
That is definitely an interesting point. A lot to dig into there on that top 100, which you can find over at baseballamerica.com. And for the Arkansas people who are listening to this podcast, for our interview coming up here in just a second here with Dave Van Horn, some more incoming talent. We talk a little bit with DVH about how Arkansas attacks the portal. This is something that Arkansas was doing before the one-time transfer exemption was put into place. They were already making good use of grad transfers, being very selective with those guys and to some good results. And that has now been expanded with the one-time transfer exception. So Arkansas fans, I'm sure, will have interest in that as well. So with that, let's get to our interview here with Coach Dave Van Horn. A lot to talk about. Arkansas, a very interesting team going into 2023, and of course coming off of a College World Series appearance. So a lot to dive into with him on the latest edition of our Clubhouse conversation, and we'll get to that here in a second. But first, check this out.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them, all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medella is your reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Today on the Baseball America College Podcast, we are excited to be joined by Arkansas coach Dave Van Horn. Arkansas, of course, coming off of another impressive season that ended with a trip to Omaha. Coach, happy to have you on and ready to talk a little bit about 2022 and a little bit looking ahead already to 2023.
Sounds great. Appreciate you guys.
All right. So Arkansas comes together with another strong season. Gets to Omaha again. Now that we've had a couple months removed from the season, you look back at the year, what are your reflections on the 2022 campaign for the Hogs?
Just really, really enjoyed the team. Enjoyed being around the guys. They were just a fun group to be around, and they really liked to play. We had some ups and downs, obviously, and at this level and in the SEC and the Western Division, you're gonna go through that. You're gonna have your good weekends and some bad weekends, and you try to stay strong. And they did. I look back at there were a lot of times when we felt like offensively we were about ready to break out of it, and then we went back into a little bit of a slump. But when you take a step back, it might have been because we were facing some really good pitching, some really good teams, and on the pitching side of it, I thought we had some guys really, really come on late. Will McIntyre jumps out at me to really help our team down the stretch. And it was definitely a team effort to get to 46 wins or whatever we were at. It seemed like it was a new couple of guys every week. So it was what a great year it was.
At your pre-CWS press conference, you always make a point to talk about just how difficult it is to just get to Omaha. And I've always kind of appreciated that in hearing you say that, because we see some of the same teams often in Omaha. And I think it can, for some people, seem like it's old hat. But I'm curious, for those who haven't heard you talk a little bit about that, if you could give voice to that and just what makes that journey so hard, that just getting to Omaha is kind of a celebration of the season you had. And yes, you want to win a national title, but to be able to kind of just celebrate and appreciate just getting to that stage.
I think anybody that's coached at the Division I level as long as I have and has had the opportunity to be in Omaha as a spectator and as a head coach of one of the teams participating, I feel like I've gained a lot of experience on how it feels. I've been there many a time where frustrated when we leave and didn't feel like we played that well. And you leave there and you're just really, really disappointed. And you're thinking, man, I don't want to come back here unless I win this thing. And then that goes away a little bit. Then you really start thinking about it, the experience that all the players have by getting there, how hard it is to get there. It's You got to go through your league. You got to stay healthy. You got to fight through regionals and super regionals. And, you know, baseball is one of those games. There's a lot of ups and downs, and it's kind of who's hot at the time. And I've learned over the last few times up there, being within one out of winning a national championship, and the next year going back again and losing 2 1-run games and leaving quick, and missing out with a team in 21 that won about everything that was put in front of us and got beat a 1-run game in the last game of the season by North Carolina State to not go to Omaha. And you just start, you realize it's difficult, and it's a celebration when you get there, and you got to enjoy it. And I've started enjoying it a lot more. I feel like that I've really just tried to tell the players to enjoy it as much as you can, but stay focused and stay serious. And I think we've done a good job with it, but it's very, very difficult to get there because of all the talent around the country. Really, when you get to the final 64 and then the final 16, and it's getting there is a major accomplishment. And if you win it, man, it's got to be great. But if you don't, you shouldn't walk out of there disappointed or with your head held down. You had a great season. You had a great run to get there.
You mentioned having to fight through regionals, and this year you definitely had to do that in Stillwater. What from the outside, that looked like an absolutely crazy regional from start to finish. What was it like being on the inside of those games and trying to figure out how you're going to get 27 outs and just face up with all the good pitching and hitting that you saw there?
Yeah, it was an unusual weekend as far as the weather. We had a light breeze blowing out pretty much from right field corner to left center. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like it was blowing 15, 20 miles an hour, anywhere from probably 5 to 12 miles an hour. And the ball was absolutely jumping. I hadn't seen the ball fly like that, I don't know if ever, unless the wind was just howling out. And some really good teams. And a lot of home runs were hit. And like you said, it started early. We played Grand Canyon, and we hit a couple home runs to give us a lead. And they hit a couple home runs to get close. And we hit a few more to finish them off. And then, you know, Oklahoma State, you know, that was an amazing – we basically ended up playing them a three-game series after that. We were down big, came back and won. And they came back and beat us in the second game. And then the third game was classic. And my eyes being in the dugout, you know, how'd I feel being in the dugout? You're right. It was like, do we have enough to slow them down? They were definitely one of the top two or three teams we played all year. You know, it's too bad. Sometimes you run into that. And, you know, if they'd have been another regional or we'd have been another regional, we might have faced each other in Omaha. But you just have to play who's in front of you. And that's what we talked to our guys about. But that was one of the toughest regional I've ever been involved in. I've been involved maybe 20 of them. I'm not sure, but it was definitely a fight. And you never felt like you had enough runs. And, you know, you wish you could match up against every hitter left, right, right, because you felt like you might have had a little better chance.
One thing I found interesting about your roster last year, again, is that you know, the transfers in a lot of ways were really playing big roles, Lane Zilli and Turner chief among them, of course. And yours is a program that's not shy about filling in the roster with transfers, even before it was as common as it is today. But you're also not a program that takes a ton of them. It seems like you guys are pretty good about finding program fits or finding guys that fit a specific need. Just generally, how do you and your staff kind of go about fitting the player need, yes, but also just fitting the program need, given that you're going to be parachuting a guy in for maybe 1 or 2 years and he's got to be able to fit in right away in order to make it work?
You know, and that we're looking all the time like everybody else. I mean, you're going to compete in the Southeastern Conference. You have to stay experienced, so to speak. You know, there's going to be some freshmen that are really going to contribute, maybe but second half of the season. They might end up being your guy on the mound or one of your best hitters, but it's tough to stay at the top of the league with young teams in the SEC and probably any league. But, you know, we feel like that we don't want to bring in too many guys. We got to bring in the right guys. And I'm sure everybody says that. We were very fortunate last year. We brought in the right guys with, you know, Michael Turner coming in after, you know, after we lost Casey Opitz and We just felt like we need an older guy. He didn't catch all the time at Kent State, but we felt like after watching video, we loved the way he caught. We loved his hands and his release, and he'd always hit. And he didn't get to play. He didn't catch a lot. He had to play third base, and it ended up being a great fit for us, and he had a tremendous season. And then Chris Lanzilli, you know, a guy that had some experience, had a super freshman year at Wake Forest and a couple okay years. He bounced back and had, I just think he needed to change his scenery, and he had a really good season for us. I think we challenged him, and, you know, he handled it, and he finished the season, you know, really swinging it well for us. He brought a little bit of leadership and personality, and you know, we've been fortunate there. We like to build within. We like to build our team around the young guys in the future. But, you know, with the way the landscape is now in Division I baseball, man, you got to get some guys. But you got to get the right guys. I think you could backfire on you if you have too many guys that want to be the guy or just really concerned about how much money they're going to make in the draft. If you have too many of those guys in your locker room, it's going to be hard to win.
For the last couple of years, you've been able to roll out a middle infield of Robert Moore and Jalen Battles. And I mean, that must have been very, you must have felt great being able to write those two guys into the lineup card day after day. But what was it like coaching them and watching them play up the middle and just what that did for your defense over the last two seasons?
Man, it was fun. I'll tell you, it's, you know, you don't run across middle infield like that at this level very often. You know, you had Robert that never missed a ball. Honestly, his I think on the score sheet or our stat sheet, it said he had two errors on the year, and one of them for sure wasn't an error. It was a double play ball he turned. It was a little bit high, and the first baseman tried to stay on the bag. All they had to do is reach up and catch it a little bit, and it went off tip of his glove, and it was on a double play ball, and the ball went and got away. And the batter runner ended up second base. And the other one was a backhand up the middle. I think it was in the super regional. I thought it was an error all the way. Ball kicked up on him, and they scored it an error. But sometimes that happens when you're a really good player. And Jalen's last year here was incredible. This past season, he got better and better and better. And we wanted the ball hit to Jalen. I mean, arm was accurate. Glove was amazing. His reads, he knew when to charge, take a step back. Just did a great job. And those guys turned double play were about as good as I've ever seen at this level. And, you know, people will ask me, how are you going to replace those guys? I says, you don't. You just hope guys develop and continue to get better. But what a fun group, fun to watch them in practice, because they brought it in infield practice. And we really, the second half of the season, it wasn't a lot of drill work. It was more about just short double play balls and just really turning the double play. And we worked a lot on it, and man, it paid off in the games.
How fun was it to see Connor Noland have the bounce back season he has? You talk about a guy that, you know, has been through ups and downs and seen it all in an Arkansas uniform. To have him be the type of workhorse that he was that last season just had to be really gratifying for your staff and the team.
You know, Connor made it was great. I mean, just to answer your question, at first, Connor was just, he's always been a great leader, but he decided to really get in the best shape of his life, and that's what he did. And man, it just made him better. And, you know, having him back and this past spring was huge for our staff, because we had some young guys that we were going to need to fill in some open spots. And, you know, he just ate up innings on Friday, game one of the SEC series. Win or lose, the guy was giving us 6-7 innings and really gave us an opportunity to win the next two games if possible. And, you know, where we didn't have to use a lot of the bullpen, and, you know, to see him pitch like he did down the stretch, I mean, in the regional, the super regional, and then in Omaha, really twice in Omaha, even the game we lost to Ole Miss, he only gave up a couple of runs, only gave up a few hits, ground ball hits, and, you know, one or two hard hit balls. But What a great effort, what a great leader, and happy for him. And, you know, the fans will always love Connor Noland in this state.
The way the draft works, I mean, you never know quite how it's going to work out. And this year it ends up with Brady Slavens and Zach Morris both coming back for next season. What does that mean, and what are you looking for those guys in terms of growth towards next year?
Well, Slavens, you know, we need to get him healthy. You know, a lot of people didn't realize this. He had some elbow problems last year, and he started out all fall playing outfield for us, elbows bothering him, and a little issue with, you know, with the nerve in there and some things. And really, he had a chance to fix it in January when they finally diagnosed it correctly, I would say. But he didn't want to because he was going to miss a lot of the season. So we DH'd him most of the season. And he had a good season, have a great season for him. I think his better days are in front of him, and I hope it's obviously this spring. I feel like now that he's got that elbow fixed, he'll miss most fall baseball, but he'll be ready to play for us. And we're gonna play him exclusively at first base and just let him get better there. He was our first baseman in 21, and we had a great season, and we'll see how it works for him again. And then Zach Morris, I mean, wow, he really came on the second half of the season. And I would say the second half of the season, he only had one bad outing, and that was in Omaha. Then he had a great outing. So we expect him to continue to take a step forward and challenge to be a weekend starter if that's what he wants to do. And there's still a lot of questions to be answered this fall here.
Had some young arms that really stepped up early and were electric for a lot of the season. Hagen Smith, Brady Tigert, those guys come to mind, at least most prominently. But how did you feel that group handled the workloads, especially those two handled the heavy workloads as the season went on? And what are you looking for from those two specifically as they look to take the next step?
I think both of those freshmen did a great job early. And then I feel like a little bit of fatigue set in, and it happens all the time with freshman pitchers. And you know, we pulled Hagen out of the starting rotation and put him in the bullpen for a couple of weeks, rested him, and then he finished strong. And then, you know, Tiger was a reliever all season for us. And, man, he helped us win a lot of games middle of the season. Struggled a little bit at the end, but I feel like he kind of ran out of gas. And I believe both of those guys are going to have tremendous sophomore years. They gained a lot of experience. They both have an opportunity to start, but I sure like both of them at the back of the bullpen as well. You know, that'll still to be determined this fall and then early spring. And I'm just excited they're young, and we know we're going to have them a couple more years.
Four teams from the SEC West show up in Omaha this last year. I mean, obviously that speaks to the depth of the division that you compete in, but what's that grind like week in and week out having to go through the West?
Well, the West it's been really good over the last 5 years, I would say, or maybe a couple more than that. I mean, the East has been extremely good as well. They've won some national championships, and you know, you can't really compare the East to the West. I mean, it's year to year, and usually boils down to who's got the pitching. And, you know, the last 2 years, the national champions come out of the West. You know, I had people throughout the season, towards the end of the season, you know, commenting that the West was down. And I kept saying, no, the West isn't down. The West is just good, and it's even. There's not much difference in talent and the way they're playing, and coaches did a great job with the teams. And but it's a grind. I mean, you hear it all the time. The whole season's a grind, but then just when you're playing division schools, you know, we're playing LSU and Ole Miss, Mississippi State, Auburn, Alabama, I mean, A&M, it's tough. And you're playing at places that are full of fans. You know, the Western Division, if you look at the national, I guess the standings ranked in order on who had the most fans that year, it's usually Ole Miss, Arkansas, LSU. And this year, I think for the first time, we ended up first. We finished second and third. And just amazing, the support of the teams in our division. And stadiums are incredible, but the competition on the field is even better.
So we will start to wrap up here and let you go. Before we do, we like to have a little fun with our guests here, and we ask them to describe for us their favorite sandwich. And some coaches will describe a sandwich they make at home. Something they just is a go-to, or maybe in the coach's office on the fly. Some describe a sandwich they get from a local place out where they are. Some, including one of your SEC rivals, Mike Bianco, described a sandwich his mom made for him when he was a kid that he really looks back on with nostalgia. So you can take it any direction you would like, coach, but this is the question the entire state of Arkansas is waiting to hear the answer to with bated breath. Dave Van Horn, describe for us your favorite sandwich.
Well, you know, I'm going to give you one and then I'll give you my favorite. I mean, nothing beats a good cheeseburger, obviously, but if you're talking just, you know, just kind of a sandwich that's made here, there, and they're hard to find, is an egg salad sandwich made correctly. And my wife makes the best ever. And I've been to some good restaurants that have had them or sandwich places, but I'm going to go with an egg salad sandwich. And I use a lot of Miracle Whip on mine too. So
I'm big Miracle Whip. That's kind of a controversial take. Some people don't like Miracle Whip, but I'm big on it. I'm with you on that, coach. Just quickly, one more. What do you, if you're making a burger, like let's say you have the entire bar of options available to you, what are you putting on the burger? Assuming it's cooked well and the flavors on the burger are good, you're not having to mask the flavor or anything.
Well, on one bun, I'm going to put a bunch of Miracle Whip. On the other bun, I'm going to put mustard. And then I'm going to go with, you know, obviously I would rather have like a homegrown, like a garden type tomato, if at all possible. Lettuce, might do a purple onion. Depends on where I'm at and what's going on. That's probably about as thick as I want to get it, because it's just a little difficult to eat after that.
Yep. No, that's fair. That's fair. That those vegetables give it that, especially that red onion, gives it that crunch. That's what you're looking for there.
Now we're going to have to go find a properly made egg salad sandwich, which, as you said, not the easiest thing. So we're all going to come to your house and we're going to get some egg salad sandwiches.
Beautiful.
We really appreciate you taking the time here, coach. It's been a lot of fun watching the Razorbacks the last few years, and I'm sure 2023 will be no different. It'll be here before we know it. And very excited to see what they look like out on the diamond this spring.
We feel the same way. We got a lot of new faces and we got to replace pretty much our whole position player team. So this fall will be very important for us, and we're looking forward to getting started here in a couple weeks.
Thank you again to Arkansas coach Dave Van Horn for joining us here on the Baseball America College podcast and our Clubhouse Conversation series. Joe, it was not the year for Arkansas that I think any of us anticipated, just in terms of the ups and downs of it. But they got there in the end. They got to Omaha. And I think that's a testament to the depth and how good Arkansas is, but also just like he mentioned there, the grind of the SEC and specifically the SEC West, that at times it was very difficult for them during the regular season, but they were very much prepared by the end of it to attack a regional and super regional, even having to go on the road for them and be ready to go and ultimately end the year back in Omaha.
Yeah, I tend to not be the one who buys into a lot of this stuff necessarily. I think there's value in it, but sometimes I roll my eyes at some of this stuff. But I do think this was the 2022 results in getting to Omaha was a culture thing with Arkansas. I mean, there were a lot of reasons why they shouldn't have got that far, right? We got the feeling they were kind of coasting through the first half to two thirds of the year, right? And then they started to hit the skids. They went 0-2 in Hoover, and you kind of thought, okay, this is, you know. And then they met some resistance. They got a tough draw going to Stillwater. It's a hostile environment against a good team, and they certainly got, you know, as we discussed in the interview, they certainly got punched in the mouth a little bit in Stillwater, and they punched back, and you know they looked like, you know, they were hitting their stride in a super regional, and then, you know, fell just short in Omaha of getting the championship series. But that just strikes me as a program that kind of knows what they're doing and knows how to get to Omaha and knows what it takes and all those cliches that, again, sometimes I'm inclined to roll my eyes at. But I do think this is a case where there is something to it. They just found a way to get there, and things didn't go perfect, right? I mean, we can talk about some of that stuff, but there were a number of guys who didn't have the offensive years that we thought they would have. And I don't think they're thankful to have had it happen, but I think if you had told them, or certainly told me, that Lanzilli and Turner were going to be their two most effective offensive players for a lot of the season, I would have thought that, oh boy, they are in real trouble. But that was the case for stretches. Those two guys really helped carry the load there. And then, you know, on the mound, they had some ups and downs. They got what they got from Nolan, probably didn't get as much as they wanted out of Jackson Wiggins, and Hagen Smith and Tigert kind of slowed down a little bit at the end with Smith eventually moving to the bullpen. Like, there were just a lot of stuff happened, right? But they fought through it all and ended up in Omaha. And I don't think that is, yes, they are super talented and we're just the better team in a lot of cases, but I think there's more to it than that. Like, I just think this is a program that just knows what they're doing, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, that's a super simplified way to put it, but there are a lot of programs that would deal with that kind of stuff and not end up where they ended up. But Arkansas found a way.
Yeah, it was definitely an impressive run. I mean, and it started in the offseason in terms of the downs or the challenges, the hurdles they had to overcome when Payne Paulette goes down injured. And I mean, that was the guy that was expected and being counted on to be the opening day starter, the Friday night ace. And all of a sudden they were stripped of that. And Nolan stepped up to the plate. And we talked with DBH about what that meant for the team and how good that was, you know, for him to have that season. But I mean, they needed it. And, you know, they, if you look at what Robert Morris' season was, I don't think that was the year that he wanted or the year that was expected of him. And, you know, Brady Slavens had, you know, as was discussed there, had some injury issues and challenges throughout the year. And I mean, the offense just never was quite, it wasn't as consistent as what we expected it to be. And, you know, I think that contributed to some of Arkansas's difficult weekends at times, but also they showed that they had more than enough to keep pace with anyone as they did in Stillwater, and just rolled through what they needed to in the postseason. And I can't, that really is as impressive a thing as they did all year, is what they were able to accomplish in the postseason, going on the road to Stillwater and then to Chapel Hill. And they took care of business so efficiently against UNC. I know we talked about it in the super regional wrap up, just that was something that was, it was over before it started. It felt like that those two games just went real quick. And yes, they were tight games, but Arkansas never really, you know, there were moments, you know, they had to come back, but they were never out of it by any stretch. They didn't require any of the crazy comebacks that they did the week before. They just went out there, they took care of business. And after such a dramatic and ultimately disappointing 2021 Super Regional, they had the absolute opposite of that this year.
Yeah, one of the things that stands out to me too is that you mentioned it made me think about this. You mentioned the Paulette injury before the season even started. Is it's not just that Arkansas finds ways to figure it out in the big picture, right? So they go through struggles and they come together as a team and they get better and they get hot and all that stuff. It's also that they figure things out on a micro level. Like, you and I have had the conversation a lot, frankly, about, you know, Arkansas shrinks down its pitching staff. You know, Dave Van Horn and Matt Hobbs, just they shrink it down pretty small by the time you get to the postseason, right? There's always, it seems like Arkansas is often in a position where it feels like they trust just a couple of guys and they're just going to go to those couple of guys at the moment of truth more often than not. And yet they do get moments like, you know, you can't just do that. And we can talk, you know, we've talked a number of times about how the Super Regional in 2021, maybe that was to their detriment ultimately, but you know, in this year, they just kind of figured it out, like on the micro level and on the individual game level, like Lord knows they got pushed in that Stillwater Regional. They had, you know, you ask them the question about, you know, just figuring out how to get 27 outs, and they did. And it's just more often than not, they do. And so whether it's Will McIntyre, you know, coming on strong, which he mentioned at the end, or a big start from a big outing from Zach Morris, or, you know, big outs from Zeb Vermillion or other guys at the back of the bullpen, whatever it was, they just figured it out. And so while it does, they do narrow it down in a lot of cases on the pitching staff, like they do find ways to push little buttons here or there that just kind of seem to work, even if it's a guy they maybe didn't anticipate having to lean on. And that's a testament, you know, whether or not we could have an argument back and forth about whether they should you know, be a little more liberal with their pitching usage down the stretch. Like, I guess we could have that debate, but you certainly can't argue with the results they get from it, generally speaking.
Looking ahead to 23, last year they brought back far more of their lineup than their pitching staff. This year flips, especially so with Zach Morris coming back. I mean, you're bringing back Will McIntyre, Zach Morris, Hagen Smith, Brady Tigard, and Jackson Wiggins. And I have no idea how those guys are going to get lined up. They all got used in ways that, you know, you could see them being in the rotation. You could see them closing. Like, they could do a number of things with those five guys. But if those are your top five pitchers and they're going to absorb the bulk of the innings that Arkansas has to offer this year, I'm pretty excited about that. They have an exciting recruiting class coming in. They hit the portal for a couple of key bats in Tavian Josenberger from Kansas and Jared Wanger from Creighton. Stovall is back after a pretty good freshman year. I have to believe there's more in the tank for him. And you get Brady Slavin's back unexpectedly, and we'll see what that looks like. But that's another big bat to have back. I mean, we have them ranked seventh right now. There's a lot to like about this team. Certainly some big holes to fill, but I do like the returning talent and the way that it's spread out on the pitching staff, especially.
Yeah, I agree. And it's kind of the thing that happens, you know, right? You talk to these coaches and then you start to like look at what you do is you just look at the roster a little harder. And because we're at a time when it's, you know, it's all upside, no downside when you're looking at rosters this time of year, you start to like really talk yourself in. And I'm like, man, you know, I actually really like this roster. Like, seven might be low. You know, so, but that's something we will do with almost literally every coach we talk to this off season. So it ends up balancing out. But one of the other guys, transfer wise, you're right to mention Wegner and Josenberger on the mound. They're also getting Cody Frank from Nebraska, who like fits right into what you're talking about on the mound, where it's like, you know, Morris and McIntyre, we kind of know what Hagen Smith is going to be, although he did pitch in the bullpen at the end of the year, but I anticipate he's kind of the guy that leads the rotation. But everybody else could, you know, you could see them in a shutdown reliever role. You could see them stretched out to be in the rotation. Frank is kind of exactly that same type of guy. You know, Nebraska didn't necessarily he wasn't anticipated to be in the rotation last year. And then Nebraska got just racked with injuries in the pitching staff. They pushed him into the rotation and it actually went really, really well. So, you know, he's a guy who kind of fits exactly into that mold where it's like, you know, he could be a high leverage guy. He misses enough bats to be a moment of truth reliever, but he's stretched out to be a starter. So he's just another guy that kind of adds to what is already looking like a pitching staff that's going to have both talent and versatility on its side.
If you're looking for downside or questions going into 23, I think my two big ones are, what are they doing behind the plate and who is playing shortstop? They have options at both. Nothing seems locked in though. And so I'll just be interested to see how those positions come out. And I'm especially interested, not so much a catcher, like we've seen them reload a catcher, but Jalen Battles was just so good at shortstop for the last few years. Like, who is going to be next and how do they work with that? And maybe that's just paying Stovall moving over to shortstop. He played first base because that was what was available on the infield last year. But that's a guy that, you know, is going to move off of first base this year. And you know, if that's it, that's fine. But I just, Battles was so good at shortstop as we talked about with DVH. What does the next shortstop look like at Arkansas?
Yeah. And you know more about Stovall than, I mean, I saw Stovall play last year, but you know Stovall more as a middle infield prospect because you wrote about him in the recruiting process. But, you know, if that's it, if they go there, you know, Josenberger is mostly a second baseman, could also play the outfield, but is, from everything I've talked to people about him, it is like a shortstop quality defender. You just have to remember he was playing at Kansas with Maui Ahuna. He was never going to play shortstop. So he played center field, he played second base, super good athlete. So that, I mean, again, to Dave Van Horn's point, you're not going to replace Battles and Robert Moore, but you know, if Peyton Stovall lives up to his advanced billing as a prospect and is able to handle shortstop, and Josenberger slots in at second, hypothetically, I mean, that's
or that's even if you flip those two.
For sure. You know? Yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cause Josenberger could do it. Like I said, it's just that he's never really had that chance, but that's a pretty, I mean, and that's life for Arkansas and all these other programs that operate at such a high level. But that's a, if you're talking about having to retool, like to be able to retool with those kinds of players, that's a good spot to be in for sure.
We'll learn plenty more about Arkansas as the fall gets underway there in Fayetteville. But I'm glad we were able to get them in early because they are such an interesting team going into this and an interesting team to follow through the fall, as we'll be doing here at Baseball America. So throughout the off season, we're going with our campus or clubhouse, excuse me, conversation series with people from around college baseball coming at you once a week here. With the Baseball America College podcast. So make sure you are subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can find me and Joe on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA, and all of the writing is over at baseballamerica.com, where this week you can find, again, those top 100 transfers. You can also see the Never Too Early Top 25, which we just referenced here. Talking about Arkansas at number 7, all of that at baseballamerica.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of our Clubhouse Conversation series, which so far has been Dave Van Horn this week. A week ago, it was Virginia Tech coach John Scheff. So getting some very, very great guests through here already, and we're going to continue that again throughout the off season. So if you are interested in hearing from anyone specific, let Joe and me know, but we're excited about the series that we're running here into the late summer, and it'll be running through the fall as well. Alrighty. Thank you all for listening to the Baseball America College podcast. We'll be back here next week. Until then, for Joe, I'm Teddy. Thanks for listening.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.